Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. It once again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show, Community Matters This Week, number 585, on the Blog Talk Radio Network, sponsored by the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse and Los Angeles Community Policing. Tonight we're doing our normal Sunday night show, which does come from LACP. LACP, standing for Los Angeles Community Policing, is an organization, a grassroots organization, that I started as basically my response to 9/11 many years ago now. It's been continuously updated. The website has every day ever since. And there are thousands of pages and lots of information that all pertain to public safety, and specifically to the generalized topic of community-based policing. Now, if you don't know what community-based policing is, this is your opportunity to learn a bit about it. I'd love for you to call in and ask any questions that you'd like to. The community-based policing concept is a philosophy that indicates that that policing is better, or safe, you have better opportunity for public safety and better services and a quality of life if the community is engaged itself in procuring that, along with, of course, law enforcement and government of different kinds. In other words, it's a relationship between the residents of any one place and the people that are hired by, to serve that order, that area, either in a law enforcement capacity or by some other service that a government would put together. It could be things as obvious as fire departments, but it could be things as unobvious as sanitation, street cleaning, grass cutting. We have grass fires here in Los Angeles and in the area, in California throughout, if everybody's aware. We have actually government is responsible for cutting down and then suppressing the fires when they come up, cutting down the fuel, though, the grasses and so forth, which are very volatile in certain years and cause a lot of damage. But then in other parts of the country, it would be a matter of flood control or hurricane rescues, all kinds of things that go on. But the point is that a prepared community and a community that is allowed to become engaged, is offered the opportunity to come in, can augment the services that we normally think of as somebody else's job, because it is somebody, certain of them are somebody else's job. We wouldn't expect, for example, a community person to take on anything involving vigilantism. Certainly they don't become SWAT officers. That's extremely well established organizations that are highly trained and have all kinds of weaponry and all of that. But there's no reason to believe that the community can't be more or less the eyes and the ears for a police department, and perhaps also volunteer, as I've done for many years, to get some training that allows the community to be effective and useful all year long, but especially in times of emergencies, and it improves the quality of life. So that's the concept for behind tonight's show. The number to dial is 646-595-2118, 646-595-2118. There is a list of current articles, or we call them LACP articles, that's in the description of tonight's show and also on the front page of our websites, LACP.org is the website that pertains to LA Community Policing, and of course, NASCA.org for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. We consider LACP to be a sister site and sister effort, while NASCA itself is a nonprofit organization. So under that umbrella, we do this show once a week on Sunday nights. We scour the obvious newspapers and cable organizations and include articles that appear on activists, social media, and official government websites. And you'll find we do cover some crime stories, a lot of resources and opinion pieces based on national, regional, and even international topics. We put them all together on a News of the Week page, and that's what you'll find when you click LACP Current Articles or LACP Articles. And that page will open up for you, and we'll all be looking at the same page. So we can use that as a source for the different topics that might come up tonight. But we're not limited to that. We're willing to talk about anything at all that has to do with public safety. And as I say, it can be local, regional, national, or international, as long as it's current events. Anything that's happened in the last week or two is fine, and I will lead the discussion. So far, we have only one other person who's called in. And I'd really try to encourage others to join in. If you've never done this show before, it's very simple to do. It's just to talk. It's just like talking on the phone, on a merged phone call, if you will, with others. And we will share the microphone with each other. So that's why it's called an open mic show. And one at a time, we'll all get to discuss any topic that comes up until it seems like that topic's exhausted. And then we'll move on to another issue or topic. That's pretty simple. The one community member that's called in is Jo Koch from Oregon. I'm delighted to see her here. I was afraid, frankly, I was going to be here alone this evening. But I'm appreciative of the fact that Jo has called in, and I'll bring her on now. As I do, let me remind you, the number for you to dial is the same one Jo used, 646-595-2118. 646-595-2118. And that phone number, by the way, is the same number we use 6 nights a week on all our shows. And we do shows every night except Saturday. 646-595-2118. Jo Koch, thank you so much for joining me this evening. It's wonderful to see you, and you're looking good tonight.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yes, this is a new outfit. And I'm doing well. How about you?
I can't complain. I hardly ever do. But I don't have a new outfit on. So you've seen this frock before.
Yes. Well, I'm glad to be here. So.
I'm delighted to have you. Thank you so much. I put out a couple of posts on Facebook very late, just now, really, just before the show. I don't know if you saw that or if you had already planned to call in, but I'm hoping it'll be noticed by someone else will call in. So there'll be, see, if we have one person here on the show, which has happened before, that's a monologue. And I can do a monologue for 90 minutes if I have to, and I have done that. When we have two people on the show, like we have right now, it's a conversation. It's two people. When we have three or more, it becomes a discussion, and that's what we're after. And we'd like to have as many as four or five, six people call in, and then it becomes a really vibrant conversation. And really, that's about the size that's good for our shows. Four, five, six people is perfect for our shows so that we can all share the mic and pass the mic and so forth. But right now, it's you and I, so we're having a conversation, but at least that's better than a monologue, believe me. All right. Have you got anything on your mind before we go to the pages that you'd like to bring up? I know you've listened to this show a couple of times, and you've expressed that you're learning things when you come on this show, and I'm really glad to hear that. I know, you know, the people that are out there would like to hear any question you might have, and I'll be happy to respond to it. I'm a fairly, for those who don't know me, I'm a fairly well-known expert in this area, in the area of public safety. I've been trained in it for years and years, always as a volunteer, never as a sworn member of law enforcement or anything like that. But I've been doing it since the 90s. and have pretty good information and so forth about these things. So is there anything on your mind that you'd like to bring up and maybe ask me a question about?
Well, once we get going, I think so. Some of these will probably bring up questions I have, and because I've looked through the topics, and some of them are really kind of interesting, and I think you'll provide a lot more help to me to clarify some of the things that happened. So,
okay, well, that's what I'm here for, and I'm not. I mean, nobody's you don't have to have any kind of background or expertise to participate in this show. I want to assure the listener that that's not required at all. Everybody, however, Joe, has an interest in kind of how public safety is accomplished. Everybody wants their own neighborhood to be safe, their own city to be safe, their own country to be safe for themselves, for their families, and their community. And that's all this is about. But there's lots and lots of ways that the community can be engaged, and perhaps we're going to run into some articles, depending on what you pick, that talk about some programs that are already in place or some opinion pieces and editorials that I know are on the list since I formatted the lists earlier today. And I'd be happy to start anywhere you'd like to go first. So why don't we ask you to pick something out, take your time, because
okay,
you're going to have a lot of opportunities to pick multiple issues, it sounds like.
What would you like to do first? I'd like to start with number two.
Number two.
In Chicago, new virtual reality training tech takes cops directly into the minds of the mentally distressed. And
right.
Should I read some of it or just,
yes,
just dig in?
Yes. So,
okay.
So our audience who's not looking at the articles gets a flavor for what we're going to be talking about. Absolutely. We read the first few sentences anyway.
Okay. Sounds good. A pilot program in Chicago uses virtual reality to help police better understand how to handle a subject in the midst of a psychiatric distress. It seems to happen almost every week. A cop in America is called to respond to some sort of disturbance. A man with a weapon, a woman disrupting the midnight calm at an apartment complex, an escalating domestic dispute. Law enforcement arrives, confusion ensues, a shot is fired, and suddenly the subject is on the ground. Only in the aftermath does it emerge that the cop was not dealing with a violent criminal, but someone having a psychiatric emergency, a schizophrenic episode, a problem with their medications, drug-induced psychosis, or a person with autism who is lost and cannot find the way to where they are going. Police in America confront these situations all the time, but they are too often untrained and incapable of effectively de-escalating the incidents towards a peaceful conclusion, experts say.
Right.
And,
okay. Now, I'm not sure what the technology they're going to use is. This is a fairly long article, so we'll pick some things out to talk about. But I will, as you do that, I'll start the topic in a general way. I have been part of this kind of training. Of course, most of my background as far as immediate law enforcement is with the LAPD and the LA Sheriff's Departments, which are giant departments. So I'm fortunate that I live in an area that's, and they're fairly progressive departments now. They weren't when I started, but they are now. And so I'm familiar with this problem and with some training that has been done in our area. I'm not sure what Chicago's pilot program is going to look like, but here's what it's all about. And, well, they said it pretty well. You get a radio call. If you're a police officer and you get a radio call about 911 has come in from an apartment building, and you don't know, or a house, and you don't know what it is. I'll tell you that if it is domestic violence, that can be one of the most dangerous things that an officer can walk into, because you don't know what's behind that door. And so they frequently in LA now, they want at least two officers at a time to show up on these things. In fact, most of the time LAPD deploys in cars that have two officers in them. This is for the safety of the officer as much as for the safety of the community. So, but they also want a second car to show up if it turns out to be domestic violence related, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But when you first come in, you don't know what you're engaged with, and that original car that shows up has to really quickly assess what's going on. There have been many times when the display of behavior that's going on with someone is extremely confusing. Could be drug induced, could be alcohol induced, could be, you know, just the person is enraged. But it also could be that the person, you know, who's waving their arms around at you and trying to and looks like they're doing something frantic is actually trying to let you know that they're deaf. And you can't tell the difference because they're just waving their arms around and you don't know. So, and also they could be, for example, in some kind of psychiatric distress, as the article says, and you don't know. In other words, they might not be violent, but their behavior can indicate that there's something bothering them, something really bad is going on, and maybe the person that's with them is all excited because they've been trying to calm the person down and can't figure out how to do it. So now you have, you know, it's kind of, you need to make these judgments fairly quickly. And God forbid, you don't want to draw a weapon on somebody who's, you know, in a sort of psychotic episode or someone that's deaf. You know, you want to assess the situation, perhaps be ready to draw your weapon if you need to, and they all have to think that way when they walk up to something like this. But don't take it out until you're sure that you're in danger or the community is in danger. So that's kind of the reasoning behind it. Now, as far as the training goes, I know I worked on putting together a video years ago in the 90s that was a training video. And law enforcement in L.A. is taught constantly, over and over and over, and consistently all through their career on whatever are the current topics, in addition to their regular training, whatever are the current topics that are going on. We had a really bad incident happen in, say it was in the early 2000s, when a person was shot because he had a flashlight, he had a large flashlight, and they couldn't tell the difference between a flashlight and he didn't have it on, but he was holding something large and black in his hand. You know, that happens with cell phones nowadays a lot, and they say, don't, you know, put your hands up, and the person goes in their pocket for their identification, and they get shot because they're not following direction. Well, maybe the person's not following direction because they're mentally somewhere else. You know, so these are the kinds of scenarios. I started to say I did a video for training that was about that first scenario, the deaf person scenario, years ago, and because we realized that we have people who are just they're not, there's nothing wrong with them beyond they have a disability, and they're trying to explain that, and either they're deaf or mute or perhaps just confused. And it's too easy for an officer to make a wrong assessment quickly. So how to walk up, how to assess, how to de-escalate the situation, bring it down to a calmer place, and that sort of thing. Now, what did you see in the article that you'd like to bring up specifically, if there is anything there?
Yeah. I thought this was very creative of whoever made the visual reality simulation. So the officers, this is in a training, the officers put on headphones and goggles, and then they said you are suddenly immersed in a jarring scene in which bright lights are flashing ominously at you from different directions. Multiple voices compete at varying volumes for your attention, and your vision blurs unpredictably. While this is happening, police officers are approaching you while a parent to the side is shouting instructions frantically to the police. No matter how you turn your head, you're trapped inside the experience. You can look around everywhere and not find yourself a way out of that scenario. You're stuck in that guy's head and you can't get out. And I thought, this is exactly what, because a lot of people haven't experienced that kind of situation where you either have somebody who's autistic who is lost and suddenly all this stuff is happening and they don't know where they are, or someone who's having a psychotic episode and who
right.
knows what that looks like. But I thought this was a great way of saying this is what the person that you're looking at is undergoing. And so try to imagine what they're going through, and maybe there's a way that you can, you know, slow down or show that you're fine, you know, that you're not coming to attack or anything, and then try to de-escalate the situation. And I thought this was a great way of doing that.
Yeah, this is coming at it from the other side, and I really like it. I'm more familiar with officers being trained about their behavior. But this is great
yeah.
because it puts the officer in the shoes of the person that they're approaching. And, of course, it is scary when you're, you know, on a street corner and a lot of, and there's, you know, all these bright lights and sirens going on around you, and they're from every angle, and people are yelling things, and, you know, sometimes traffic is going by. It's very confusing. I like this a lot. That they put the
mm-hmm.
Officer, they allow the officer to experience something similar or as close as they can, I suppose, to what perhaps that autistic gentleman might be feeling. And you know, I think this is great. I really do. I mean, I'm familiar with training that has to do with the officer's reaction. I've been on a lot
mm-hmm.
of training where you are put in a virtual reality room. And you are presented with scenarios that are displayed on the walls around you, and they're projected
mm.
there, and you don't know what you're walking into. But again, you're doing it as an officer, and you
mm-hmm.
what you do know when you're doing this training is that some of the scenarios are going to involve dangerous situations for either your fellow officers, yourself, or the community, and you have to react appropriately. But others are extremely innocent. And the whole idea is to teach the officer in that case to not shoot, you know, how long can you wait and so forth. And invariably, everybody that takes this training kills someone with quotes around it that they shouldn't though. Because you go through maybe 10 of them and they score you on the 10 of them. And many times you'll kill multiple people in the process of taking this training. It's shocking. But again, that's
wow.
the officer being taught how an officer needs to assess, not the other. And I love this, that they're putting the officer in the situation where the victim or the community
mm-hmm.
member is having an experience that, you know, otherwise you might not even imagine was what they're seeing, you know, what they're seeing and feeling
right.
and hearing. I love it.
Yep.
I love
yeah.
it.
I was this reminded me of a program called Welcome to My World that I helped put all of the employees at Portland General Electric in Portland, Oregon through. And it was a scenario of they had where they had wore blinders and they had to go out and try to cross a street where they were in a wheelchair and tried to get around places. And one of them was a mental illness scenario where they have people talking on both sides of you while you're trying to concentrate on something. And it's the it's sort of the schizophrenic type of inner talking that and just shows what it's like. And so this reminded me of that, but in a much more interactive and realistic way. So I thought this was good.
Love it. Love it, love it, love it.
Yeah.
Absolutely great. You did that for a company, huh? The gas
yes.
company, was it?
Yeah.
Electric?
Well, yeah.
Yeah,
Portland General Electric. It was, very good. A utility, and they had, they wanted awareness for their employees. And one of the programs was, it's called Welcome to My World, and there were several different aspects to it. And so I did several of them. I had, at the time, I had a fairly strong visual problem, so I went I did the blindness walk once, and I did the hearing impaired one because I learned a little sign language. And so I went to each one of them, and I found that the one that the most people had trouble with was when there's talking in their ears, and they can't concentrate. And that just tells me that people who, you know, the way seeing someone who is exposed to this for the first time getting so wound up and so upset just sort of said, wow, this is just a one-time thing. What if you have to live with that every day? And so I'm thinking that this BR training that they're getting says, wow, this is what some people have to live with every day. And just gives them a little awareness, a little welcome to my world type thing. So it was great.
I also like the fact that they're using more advanced technology than was available when I was doing this training that I'm talking about, because as I understand it, it is like putting on a set, like a sort of a headset and a goggle situation. Virtual reality these days is not so much the displaying of things on a wall as just displaying in your consciousness. It's inside your head that you are seeing things that are there and hearing things that are there that are not, they're very real, and they're kind of immediate, and they can be manipulated by the, there's a person who does this training, at least in the ones that I'm familiar with, and someone else who's assessing it. And so you actually run a kind of a control panel, and you keep score and so forth or whatever, and you assess how well the officer that's doing the training is doing, and perhaps adjust accordingly. But this is wonderful because it's an additional use of virtual reality that, as I say, you know, I'm such an old guy. They didn't have when I was doing it.
Me either.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I thought what I was doing was pretty advanced back then. I guess it was. But, boy, anytime they can add, you know, a little more reality to the VR, virtual reality, you use that expression, that's you know, so much more the better and more lifelike, if you want. You know, I'm all for this kind of use of technology.
Yeah. But I think you did a great job with what you had at the time. So you used the resources you had and really focused on the training. So that was good, especially if it turned out that, you know, there were several unfortunate shots taken. So during that. That gives them pause before they are out in a real situation. And
well, I tell you, training like this goes on all the time. Okay, obviously, if you're a rookie, you go through something similar to what I did probably when you're at the academy. But officers are given firearms training every month at LAPD. Every officer, and there are 10,000 of them. They're required at a minimum. They're required to go to the range, and shoot, you know, at targets. Do target practice, in other words, and they are assessed on the every aspect of firearms and their use of firearms all the way through their career. Once a month, it takes a lot of coordination to pull this off. But that's how sincere the department is here about making sure the officers are extremely, you know, familiar with the different weapons they might have to use, certainly. And then in addition to that, they go into training of the type we're talking about, which has more to do with not the weaponry, but the scenario. And you have to combine those two, you know, to be an effective patrolman. And and then there are, as I said earlier in the show, there are some jobs that are obviously much more complicated and involve, you know, SWAT, for example, I brought up. SWAT is Special Weapons and Tactics. If you're on the SWAT team, and not very many people make it, you know, to the SWAT team, it's kind of like being a SEAL team member of the armed forces in the Navy. It's super training. You train all the time. And they have several training facilities that are sort of mock-ups of buildings and even towns, little town, is one of them, is a little town. And you don't know what you're walking into, and you have to answer the sort of the call of the day in a training scenario, and everybody is super trained in that division. But that's unusual. However, even those people, they train all the time, and the officers are too, in one way or another. It might be at roll call. They're shown one of these videos I was describing. It might be they go back to the academy for refresher courses, and they might go through the VR training that you brought up in this article. They might go to legal classes. There may be changes in the law that are discussed. Traffic law changes. In the fire department, every officer in the fire department is now a paramedic. Every one of them. And they have 120 something stations around the city. And so every fireman is a trained paramedic, and then every station also has at least one emergency bus, an ambulance, which are manned by EMTs as well. So there's a huge amount of emphasis on public safety, huge. And I'm impressed by how far they go to make sure that they're doing the right thing in the right way, for the right reason. And, there's a lot of oversight. There's a lot of record keeping. There's a lot of auditing of every officer's behavior nowadays. Mm-hmm. They're assessed on a local level by their own captain if there's a complaint against them. And if the complaint is relatively easy to adjudicate, or if it's frivolous, the captain can handle it there. But now there's a kind of a tiered method of responding to complaints, so that if something's more serious, it goes to a special unit that does further investigation, and it can ultimately end up in the inspector general's office, which is run by the police commission itself. So there's tiers of reporting that's done, and investigation that's done. In fact, the inspector general, just as an aside, shows up at every use of force everywhere in the city every time. Somebody from their office shows up and makes their own report. So you not only have the police officers, the patrolmen, the detectives, perhaps the CSI type people, and all of that, but you also have a legal person showing up there to assess how the situation went down and whether the actions of the department were in policy, they keep records of all these things. They audit them all the time. So anyway, the point is there's a big emphasis on public safety, huge, that there didn't used to be. Yeah.
Yeah. That's wow. That's a lot. While you were talking, you were it brought up a question that I had I took a class from our local police here on it was a women's self-defense class, and they were talking about the different levels of awareness, and that you don't want to be totally unaware, but that we want to be, when we're walking around, we want to be in a state of, they say, like yellow, which is just, being aware of what's going on. But they say that police officers are in a constant state of orange. And
yes.
I don't know that I could do that. I don't know that I could stay in that heightened sense of super awareness and things. Wow.
Yeah, it's a different mindset, and it's a different set of eyes. And it's a different, you use the word awareness, aware. It's a different reality. They live in a different reality than most of us do. And they're constantly on call, basically. In certain parts of the country, in New York City, which is where I'm from, and I do have some experience with policing there too, there was a time, and I'm not sure that it's continued. I want to be upfront about that. I could be wrong about it today. But there was a time when every officer, regardless of where they were and what they were doing, was required to carry a firearm. Just because You know, if you were on duty or off duty, it didn't matter. You were required to carry a firearm, have it with you. So they had 36,000 or something officers at that time, I think. And by far the biggest, with LA being the second biggest department in the country. And all of those 36,000 officers were constantly, you know, like you say, orange. Some of them were red, obviously.
Wow.
They were active
uh-huh.
duty. But even the ones that weren't were orange. It didn't matter if they were in their personal car, riding a subway, they'd gone to the beach. They had to have a firearm with them all the time. I mean, it's amazing.
Wow.
But that's how it was. I'm not sure that policy is still in place, but it wouldn't shock me if it was.
Wow. Yeah.
Oh. Now, both these cities, the crime rate has gone down significantly from where it was when I started doing this work in the 80s and 90s, and significantly so. But it's only because they were, you know, really, really devoted to the kinds of things we're talking about, to the training, to the practical problems that an officer might have. And I like this Chicago article because it puts the officer in the shoes of the community member as well. So it gives them that experience. And, you know, they're not thinking of that. We always talk about the band of brothers, or the thin blue line and all those kinds of terminologies. They all have to do with officers taking care of each other. And they're really conscious of that. But I don't know how conscious they are about being a regular community member, because after a while, you obviously start off as a community member. Every officer does. But once you get into policing, after a few years, your mindset, you now have a basic set of experiences that do change your mindset. And, you know, they're well aware of that, too, in law enforcement. So they try to direct the energy in the right direction nowadays.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Well, a lot. I've always had respect for them, but I have a lot more compassion for them now, too. Because that to me, it would be just not a life I would want, to be constantly on orange alert.
It's not a life for everyone, Joe. Mm-hmm. It's it's a calling, really. It is. It's a vocation and a calling. And I think once you're a public safety member of the public safety community, that whether you're a police officer or a fireman, it doesn't matter where you go, other policemen and firemen are your companions, brothers and sisters in the same kind of job. It is a calling. So
thank you. Well, that's the main part.
All right, great. Well, that was a great article. Thank you for picking that.
Yeah, I really like that one. So you've got one?
Let me take a moment to remind people that if they're listening to the show, we'd love for them to call in. And that the call-in number is the same one we use every night except Saturday. We do shows 6 nights a week, every night except Saturday. And Sunday night is a little different than the other nights of the week. Sunday night, as you're now aware, if you're listening, is devoted to the general topic of public safety and how the community can be involved in helping itself stay safe, helping law enforcement stay safe. Part of that is what we just discussed, is understanding law enforcement a little better. Put yourself in their shoes, and you will see that this is not an easy job. We ask a lot of our public safety officials. And, it helps us to understand what they go through. But it also, just as this article says, helps them to understand what we go through. So we do this show on Sunday nights. Monday through Friday, we do shows that are all devoted exclusively to child abuse and the trauma from child abuse. It's prevention, intervention, and recovery. And the topics usually spring from NASCA, NAASCA.org, NAASCA.org, which is the website for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. Tonight's show, Sunday, is the one, the show that we do that's a little different, and it is devoted to issues of public safety, and it is, and there is a website for that too. It's LACP, which stands for Los Angeles Community Policing. But we discover that there's community policing going on all over the place. Some of the articles in here are international articles even. So we're talking about local, regional, national, and international topics, and it's a current events show, discussion show, where we can talk about anything we'd like, especially if it's happened in the last week or two, any current event type thing. And you just have to dial in to get hooked up to us at the same number we use 6 nights a week, which is what I started with. The number is 646-595-2118, 646-595-2118. Joe Koch and I will lead this discussion, but we would love for you to call in, and you can pick the next topic when we resolve. We just finished one topic, but we have plenty of time to go on to something else. There's a set of articles that's available that can be used for this, but it can also be just something that's going on in the world today, in your world today, or in the world today, that you would like to hear discussed. 646-595-2118. And I do not have any special articles tonight that I've picked out ahead of time, so I'm happy to go with your lead here, Joe. We got plenty of time, so yeah. You said there were a few things that you liked, so
yeah.
I'll tell you what.
Well,
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Two articles below the one we just discussed: "The Life in Recovery, From Using His Police Badge to Score." To helping those in recovery. This is an article of an officer named Michael Lowe, and it's a fairly lengthy article. I'm not going to read the article. I'm going to give you the overview of the article, and then we can talk about it. But it's a police officer who got himself in some trouble, he passed out behind the wheel of his patrol car. When he was high, he got high, and drove into a parked car, and he went into a drug rehabilitation, he was convicted of not only being addicted, but of embezzling and prescription fraud, drug fraud, and he ended up with a 6-month prison sentence. So his cop career was destroyed, but out of this came the path for the rest of his career, the rest of his life. After his 6 months was over, he was offered the opportunity to, eventually he was offered the opportunity to give back by serving in a treatment center that he had once gone to, the Maple Leaf Treatment Center. And this is happening in Vermont, by the way. And it turns out that he says, and he's interviewed a lot of interview here, that, the Xanax-fueled cruiser crash, they call it, that he was originally in, led him down a path where he had to become responsible for everything that he'd done. And then he found a new way to serve, which was by giving back in terms of his own recovery. He knows that he knew that he would never be a cop again. Obviously, you can't have a felony on your record and be a cop. So, but he did end up being a counselor, and whereas he thought his life was over, it gave him a brand new life. Now, the substance and alcohol abuse programs of the type that he's been involved in for a number of years now is really important to the community. And sometimes I think I want to bring this up mainly because, I myself am in recovery for a long time, and any number of people who might be listening could be too. And one of the things that we fear is that our life is over when we are discovered or when we get in trouble. Sometimes we get DUIs. Sometimes we go through domestic violence. Sometimes all kinds of sort of ramifications that follow when you are an addicted person, either to alcohol or drugs or both. And I just want to say, like him, you know, I have found that, you know, it was simply the path to another kind of life, but the path that I think, the way I look at it, that I was supposed to be on. And I couldn't have predicted that, but it does seem to be the path that I was supposed to be on. And all of what I've done in recovery, which for me now has lasted quite some time, you know, has been in a direction where I have been able to be of service specifically because of my background and experience. Now, this is true for people who are in recovery from child abuse as well. It doesn't have to be just this. Mm-hmm. You know, this, I mean, it doesn't have to be substance abuse. It can be any kind of traumatic experience that you think has wrecked your life. It's possible to turn that around and make it the most important thing that ever happened to you, frankly. This is how I see it. It's not how I saw it at first, believe me. but that's how I see it now. And, you know, a lot of my activity, which led up to NASCA and all that, started, you know, by trying to give back a little bit of the hope that I had received when it was time for me to get into recovery, which was substance abuse and alcohol abuse, and then recovery from the trauma at the same time was going on too.
Wow.
I came to the conclusion that the worst thing about me, which I thought was the history I had come to have, turned out to be the best thing about me, because it's what I have to give away to offer somebody else, just my experience and my strength and my hope. And so that's what Michael Lowe found out was true for him too, a police officer who lost his job because of his drinking and using and his criminal activity, but found himself in the process.
Yes. So. Yeah. Well, and congratulations on your being, I call it being knocked back on path, on your path, for your journey.
Okay.
That's what I sort of took it as. Sometimes you need to crash your car to get back on track. I'm going to get a little soppy, but anyway, I believe that everyone is here for a reason and has a purpose. And sometimes I'll take myself as an example. If I don't recognize my purpose, sometimes I need just to have a little, you know, whack upside the head, says, hey, how about over here? And then I can get, and I see, oh, this is, I have something to contribute here now because of my experience that I had. Maybe I didn't like when I was going through that experience, but I have something to share and to help others with. And that's what he did. That's what you did. And a lot of people do that. But sometimes we have to get to the point where we are so far off the path that we crash and have to be led back to the path or you know, find it again, because we've been on sort of an automatic pilot and just didn't make that corner that we were supposed to on the path. So I think it's always good that people can turn themselves around after a situation of a really rough situation like that, or yours, or you know, any of the our experiences, and can say, okay, I've learned from this, and what can I do now? Now that I have all this experience, what can I do to turn that around? And I think this is great. And for you,
and I
especially.
I further think that, you know, sort of the philosophy of life that includes being a bit egalitarian, if you will, and offering your life in service to others is kind of one of the highest callings. And there are people who have the unfortunate, you know, thinking of it that they have in their head. Their head says, oh, my life is over now. Well, no, it could be just beginning now, depending on what you do with it. And it really does. That's what it depends on. You can choose a path that is, you know, destructive, and disabling. And but you can put some. You can also put energy into recovering from whatever it is that's brought you to this low place, and use it in such a way that it becomes the, like I say, the gift of your life, the thing you have to offer somebody else that they really need. And we know, Joe, you and I know, and any of our NASCA members know, that this is true for us. That's why we become activists and we become members of NASCA, because that's what NASCA is all about. It's about serving mm-hmm. each other and educating the public, those two things. And, you know, we have an opportunity. If there's a newcomer out there that's listening to this and they haven't really thought about it this way, I just want to assure them that the opportunity is there for them to have a really full life based on the fact that they have the very experience that they thought was the worst thing about them under their belt, and they can use that for good, with a lot of good. We know that there are well over 45 million American adults, something like that, in our country who suffered childhood sexual abuse. Before they were 18, they were sexually assaulted or multiple times assaulted, like I was. And, you know, when we emerge from that into our adulthood, we begin to keep the secret and think it's the worst thing about us and the thing we're going to take to our grave, the story we'll never tell anyone, and all of this. And, of course, there are dramatic effects of that, usually in terms of our behavior and our choices and decisions and so forth. And when we get into recovery, when we get the message that NASCA carries, and it's saying that no matter how far down you've gone, you can get back up, and we will help you, and the whole community will help you. So you're never going to be alone again in this. And someday, if you follow this path, or a path similar to the one I've followed and you followed, Joe, you could emerge mm-hmm. Actually grateful for the fact that you, not for what happened, but for your understanding of it and mm-hmm. the tools that you've learned in the interim that have gotten you to have a more productive, normal, comfortable, a better life. And you can pass that on. That's what we're all about.
Perfect. That's
I love
perfect.
This article because it was that mixture. It was the law enforcement mm-hmm. and the recovery mixture. So I wanted to make
mm-hmm.
sure you mentioned it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a good one. That's a good one. Yeah.
So I'm ready to move on to whatever appealed to you next.
All right. I was about three articles down. It's sort of in the middle. It's from Louisiana. And Baton Rouge ahead of the curve in use of software to predict where crime's most likely to occur. We had a discussion about software previously, but what I liked about this one, which starts in the second paragraph, so I'm going to just read the first couple paragraphs. With crime risk analysis data on the computer monitors, a GIS analyst for the city talked about his findings in Baton Rouge. Dumonville is presenting, that's the guy's name. He's presenting an upcoming conference in Spain on crime risk analysis, which is using geographical data like blighted properties, convenience stores, past crime scene locations to predict where crimes are most likely to occur and to distribute Baton Rouge police department officers accordingly. Apparently, Baton Rouge is ahead of the curve on this trend, which experts say help improve community relations by focusing on where crimes occur instead of who's committing them. I thought that was the biggest thing, it's not focusing on the people, it's focusing on where the crimes have occurred. And it says it also increases department efficiency, which is a big deal now given serious manpower issues. But that, to me, is what I was thinking where the previous one that we discussed should have been going, where that analysis, where that data analysis and the programming should have been going, is to the blighted properties, the past crime scene locations, and not to the people who committed them and where they live or who's their neighbors or whatever. So, but I wanted your opinion on that.
Okay, well, I have a lot to say about Baton Rouge. It needs this. First of all, let me say that, just be honest. Baton Rouge is a high-crime city, and it has been for some time. So anything they can do to improve community relations is really important. I will also note that the previous time we spoke about this, which was going back a few weeks now, the term that was used in that article was predictive policing. And it became a kind of a misunderstood term. They were doing some of what Baton Rouge is doing here and calling, what did they call it in the article up at the top there? You just read it.
Crime risk analysis. Yeah, crime risk analysis.
Mm-hmm. Risk analysis is also used at LAPD, for example. In essence, it's using the audits that I mentioned before in a different way than just keeping track of statistics. It's implementing the audits in such a way that you can use them in a variety of ways. Instead of going after the criminal element, the individual here, they're going after the geographic element, the neighborhood, the corner, the part of the city, and so forth. But it's basically risk analysis is all about, it is predictive policing. They're trying to tell us and I don't like the name predictive policing. That was part of the problem, mm-hmm. I think, with trying to sell that as a concept. Because it did kind of blame the community member more mm-hmm. than this does. And I think that's why people were saying, well, what makes you think that my neighborhood's any worse than anybody else just because we're people of color over here? You know, and there are some quite blighted areas in Louisiana, and Baton Rouge is one of the has a lot of high incidence of violent crime. And there are many people of color, all throughout the South. So there is a perception that it's us against them as far as the black community is concerned, for example, and police departments, even if the officers themselves are black, you know, they're seen as blue. It's like blue against black. And so I am very happy to hear that Baton Rouge is getting serious about anything that involves bringing the community into the equation, which at least it sounds like the presentation that was done that's community policing. The presentation itself is community policing. If you go out in the community and you try to explain what you're doing, hopefully you're also listening to what the community is saying in response to that. And that's community policing. It's the interaction and the sharing back and forth. It's a partnership, in other words, of the concerns of the neighborhood, which maybe you don't understand because all you're looking at is statistics and you're not getting the human element. So I really appreciate that Baton Rouge is doing this because they are not, let's say they're not the example police department you'd probably want to start a police department, you know, start up. And they haven't been for a while. So if they're on the upturn, that's good. That's really good.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good background because that must be why they say why being ahead of the curve was so big for Baton Rouge then, is because from where they were coming from then, yay, Baton Rouge.
Yeah, it was more like a good old boys type police department for a while, you know. I don't want to use the word redneck, but it's like that. It's like, this is countrified policing, frankly. It's not a huge city. It's not a New York. It's not a Philadelphia. It's not a Dallas. It's Baton Rouge, which is a small city, but a very vibrant one. A lot of traffic goes through Baton Rouge because it's on or right off the 10 down there, and it is a coastal city. New Orleans was experiencing some similar growing pains as it went through the last couple of decades and the first decade of, last century and this century, where they had not yet kind of incorporated some of the better thinking that the best practices, let's say, of departments that were a little ahead of them in terms of using modern technology and training and, you know, that kind of thing. So Baton Rouge had earned a reputation, unfortunately, of a kind of a blue against black
in a situation, even if the officers were themselves African American, didn't matter. They were seen as cops, and all cops were seen as quote bad, and they were overreactive, frankly, in some cases. So if they can do this kind of work now, what they're talking about again, it takes away the emphasis on the essentially the criminal element that lives in a part of town, right? And it puts it on more on the kind of neighborhood you have, and this is this speaks to one of the most important things that community members can do, which is to clean up their neighborhood, and literally clean up their neighborhood, because it has been shown for many years now that the neighborhood that looks better is less attractive to the criminal element. They see it as a community that cares about itself. It's not that you're going to be crime free, but it is going to be that it's likely that your statistics will go down as you repair buildings or even tear them down, blighted buildings, you keep the streets clean, as you plant gardens, as you put up signage that's sort of attractive. Anything you can do, even paint your own house, indicates and use light, clever use of lighting, and that kind of thing. All these things are elements that if you can add that to the community that's blighted, the whole community might be blighted, will make it less attractive to the criminal element. And that's, I think, what all of us are interested in. In other words, you don't stop crime. What you do is you improve the quality of life, and crime goes down as a result. And that's stuff the community can and should do.
Yeah.
I
agree. Yeah. Also, I was thinking, too, was if these blighted properties are cleaned up, then more people are more likely to move into that area. And then you'd have more people around, and that provides more energy to keep the that area, to improve that area as well. So it's not just getting rid of the blighted areas isn't just for to take away the places where the criminal element likes to handle, but also provides more places for others to move into who have a community spirit that can then expand the neighborhood.
Now, I want to say that in badly blighted areas, you will need the services of the government to help you. And I can cite several examples. In my head, I'm thinking of Detroit, which, once was a powerful big city and had a lot of industry and was doing very well for many years. It did very well. And then the auto industry left and Detroit crumbled. And there are huge stretches of Detroit as a result where there are simply abandoned buildings. They're just sitting there and they're falling apart. Some of them are commercial. Some of them are residential. They're all problematic because, just as you say, they attract an element you don't want. Some of them become shooting galleries, drug use galleries. Some of them they attract transient type people. Some and they all, just as you say, detract from whatever nice, homes might have been at one time around there. Property values plummet when you're in an area like this. It's a practical thing to deal with those kinds of properties and these kinds of situations. You might have to have the city tear them down. They may not be recoverable, especially after a few years. Some buildings are no longer able to be used as either a business or a residence. They're not occupiable. And to let them sit there and deteriorate on their own is really doing yourself a disservice. If you could get the city behind the agreement to remove certain things and revitalize other things, Detroit actually has made some strides in this, by the way. They have some areas that they've devoted energy to that actually are pretty attractive. Some have become artist communities. But again, anything that shows a sort of a vibrancy is a step in the right direction. And it will have the added benefit of increasing the property values of those people that, you know, who own homes or properties around them. So it's practical,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
Never mind that. And it's more pleasant to live there. So you're attracting people to come down and consider, you know, that. Now, it can be as extravagant, as they say, as tearing down buildings. But it could also be as simple as we have a program in L.A. because we had so many gangs, and I've talked about this before, but it's worth mentioning. So many gangs, 350 individual gangs in Los Angeles, okay? Some of them as small as four people. Some of them as big as hundreds. But they're all over the city. And some parts of the city have more problems with the gangs than others. The gangs basically mark their territory, generally speaking, by using graffiti. Graffiti is a bane to a nice neighborhood. You know, it is the bane of nice neighborhoods. That's where it begins. You know, if you allow that graffiti to remain, then the gang has staked their territory. And really, the communication, and there are people that can read graffiti very well. Certain officers actually can tell what's going to go down based on the graffiti that's left behind on any particular weekend or evening. And they can read the graffiti. And and it's messages from one gang to another. So one gang will put up graffiti, another gang will come on and put an X through it and write their response below it. I mean, it gets ridiculous. But it all of it tends to leave the regular community member who's on their way to work every night, you know, and when they come home and they see their neighborhood like that, you know, pretty disgruntled. You know, how come, even if nothing has really occurred to them, because a lot of the criminal activity is gang on gang, but you still don't want bullets flying anywhere in your city, you know, and they do a lot of car thefts. That's grand larceny, of course. They do burglaries. They do some stick ups occasionally, but mostly they're rivals against each other for territory. So what LA did years ago now was institute a program where they hired, I think it was 15 different contractors. And those contractors were given the job of going around the city and getting rid of graffiti. It ended up being a very strong program that's still in place today, where you can call in the location of some new graffiti and it's gone in 24 hours. That's it can't be allowed to stay, because it defeats the purpose for the gang member that puts up graffiti to have it erased overnight or the next morning. They want it to stay up there as their moniker, you know, their signage. And in my neighborhood, it's been extremely effective. And others, not so much, but it's getting better all over the city. And it was once a horror here, you know, it was so graffiti. So that's a program the city invested in, but got contractors to do the work. And the contractors are doing a pretty good job. They drive around following, you know, they know the neighborhoods. They're each designated, I guess, 1/15th of the city of Los Angeles. And they are given the job of, they have matching paints. There are a series of paints that are sort of city colors. And there's a whole bunch of them. Sort of a rainbow of paints. And then there are specialty paints. And if you have a specialty, like say your garage door is painted a special color, they will even mix that color for you and leave it for you if you're willing to do it yourself. And so you'll have your own, 5 gallons worth of the special yellow that you like your garage door painted or whatever. But most of the time it's grays and browns and whites, you know, and that kind of thing. And it's amazing because it has really improved the look of everybody's neighborhood, and it has caused the rise of property values, no question. Pretty
good.
Simple,
yeah.
But really important. And it had been the bane of a lot of neighborhoods, as I say, for a long time, till they figured out how to do it. And we're all grateful, believe me.
that's good. That's a very creative way of doing that. And I guess I'm wondering why more cities don't tear down blighted buildings, especially that or even houses that haven't been
you know, that have just been vacated and that no one has ownership of, and why they leave them up, because they're not getting anything. They're not getting any property tax out of that or anything. So why don't they do that?
It has to go through a long process for the city to claim that responsibility, because all these properties are owned by somebody. These are owned by somebody. They're on the books as being, you know, as being titled to one person or another who may not have paid their taxes, but they're still titled to that person. So you may have to go to court with them over and over. There's a whole process of things that have to happen. Others are owned by businesses, and where is the business that the, you know, that owns the property? You can't just go up to a property because it looks bad and tear it down. In other words, you have to go through a lot of legalese to get it to that place. And then once you do, you know, it's expensive. So that's another block. You know, tearing demolition and removal of all the debris is not cheap. So it's an investment. And then what are you going to do with the property? Well, I mean, I know of a property over here in the next neighborhood from mine, Lincoln Heights, which was a drug house. Everybody knew it. It had been there for a long, long time, maybe even a couple generations. And they finally got control of the place, because what happens is the title gets passed from one person to another, and there's a kind of a paper chase that has to be followed in order to make sure that you're actually dealing with the owner, not their cousin or their son, or, you know, it has to be the owner that you evict eventually. And but this particular place I'm thinking of was torn down eventually. It took a long time for them to do it. And in its place, I'm going to say could be as much as 10 years later now, there's a very nice two-story brand new home built there. Obviously somebody bought the property and invested in construction. And so in the place of this terrible, in between for the 10 years, it was pretty much an empty lot, a little empty lot, small, but big enough for a house. And somebody came along and bought the property and did invest in it enough to build a home. And it's a nice looking place. But this is not quick fixes. That's not quick. It takes a long time and dedication. Another thing a city can do is a lot of the properties that are blighted, they do end up owning. Or they're bank owned, and you have to buy the property away from the bank as a city and then take ownership of it, do the demolition and the cleanup, and then offer it for sale. So the city becomes a real estate agent then. It's complicated. It's complicated.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, I guess I didn't realize that they were still owned. I thought they were just abandoned, and that you could do eminent domain or something to take them over. And it seemed like an empty lot would be less conducive to criminal behavior than a building that has, you know, walls and you can hide in or whatever. So I don't know, but that's just my naive me. So I didn't realize that people still own those.
No, you're right. An empty lot is better than a building that's decrepit or a drug house, obviously.
Yeah.
But to get it to be an empty lot, there has to be an awful lot of work done, you know, as far as finding out who owns it, getting them to out of it, maybe buying it away from them or buying it away from the bank that's foreclosed on it or whatever, because all property is assigned, all of it. It's assigned to somebody. It's titled to an individual or a company or a community. The city may own it. The county may own it. The state may own it. You know, there's nothing that's not owned I don't know about nothing, but there's almost nothing that's not owned by somebody as far as our country is concerned.
That's true. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that.
All right, we have 15 minutes left, Joe. I hope people are enjoying our conversation, but I certainly am.
I am too. Yeah, I'm learning lots, and that's one of my goals, is to learn lots. So
we have time for another topic or an article, either one you'd like, whatever you'd like. 15 minutes left.
Okay. I hadn't looked
Let's see. I hadn't looked at the one that's a little further down, like three or four more down. It was called New York Viewpoint, Renew Focus on Community Policing. And there's
okay.
another, you got it, another shooting by a police officer and then another act of police brutality strained the relationship between the community and the Albany Police Department. This is Albany, New York. As a consequence, they're in danger of losing 10 years of positive strides made through the city's community policing initiative. And then it says it takes time. This is a viewpoint thing. It's time to take serious steps to repair any damage to the public partnership with law enforcement and restore strong community policing to the streets of Albany. It sounds like the main thing I had on this was, it sounds like even if you have set up a really good community policing, and there was a term for it, was it COPS, COPS, there was something like that, that doesn't guarantee it's going to be maintained, that it could just sort of wither away if the major movers and shakers that set it up in the first place move or shake somewhere else. And I was wondering if that is an example, or is that a possibility or a common occurrence that community policing organizations are only as good as the members who initially created them, or as strong as the
Yes, this is an opinion piece, as you said, it's an op-ed kind
sure.
of thing.
Yeah.
I didn't have the word opinion there. I just put it there, by the way, while you were talking. I realized it.
Oh, okay.
I try to identify these as to what kind of thing we're going to see, either the geographic location, certainly, but also if it's an editorial or an opinion piece, and this is.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so here's the deal. Not everything is fluid. Everything is fluid. And
mm-hmm.
I predict that someday, even in an area as strong as mine in terms of the commitment to community policing, that there will come along, for example, a chief who is picked who is not a huge fan of community policing. And because of that, it'll trickle down through the department that we don't have to pay that much attention to the community anymore. That kind of thinking will happen. This has been going on for eons. And I got to say, community policing is not new, not at all new. As a matter of fact, if you think about it, community policing goes back at least as far as the 1800s, because the first police departments weren't formed until in England. They were formed. They became formed in Great Britain, in London. And that was where the first sort of official police department went. Before that, you had marshals, and you had sheriffs. And in our country, we certainly had that system of public safety. And, you know, whenever the sheriff needed help or the marshal needed help, he would put together what? A posse, right? A posse was a group of community members. Sometimes they were paid, but most frequently they weren't. They were just going to go after the bad guy. And that's community policing. They'd all get on their horses. Instead of one person going after the bad guy, now there'd be eight going after the bad guy. And those people were community members. That's, in essence, what community policing is all about. Now, we don't live in the Wild West anymore, although we have a lot of arms around us all the time. We're not encouraging that. But I just want to point out that that's kind of how policing was done until they came up with the concept of police departments. As I say, it started in Great Britain, but it quickly came here. And now you had people who were essentially, there were people who were originally, they were kind of night watchmen. They would go around and they would light, for example, the gas lamps in cities. And they would, and the streets were lit up for the first time in the 1800s. You know, they didn't have lights. They didn't have electricity. Then most people went in at night because it was dark. When the gas lights came along, and then further when the electricity came along that replaced them, now you had a vibrant nightlife in certain parts of the country, in certain parts of the country, urban parts of the country. And you had a lot of people out. and that had never been done before. You also had vehicles came along around the same time, and there were no roads. They were still mud paths, you know. But over time, as it got, you know, as we progressed as a society, they saw a need to make designated public safety people, police officers, if you will, out of these night watchmen and people similar to them. So now police departments were frequently people that went around. And frankly, at first, we didn't have a lot of armed police officers. Great Britain still doesn't. It has enough that it has an armed service too, but it didn't take long before we started to arm our officers, and it kind of coincided with the advent of the Badland gangs, which became gangster gangs, you know, and in the era of the early 1900s, you know, you had a lot of trouble. In fact, you know, gangsters were able to use their own vehicles. Now roads were starting to be paved, not all of them, but some were. And now, you know, the vehicle was just as much, it's just as important to the criminal as anything else, because it was a getaway thing. You could quickly get away if you had a bigger, better, badder car. Plus, they could arm themselves better. And, you know, there was a period of several decades when they were almost idolized by the community, frankly, because it was the Depression. And they were getting away with something. I think secretly a lot of community members thought, geez, I wish I had enough guts to go, you know, rob a bank and get away with something, because I'm starving over here with my family. But anyway, I'm making light of it. The point is that community policing is not a rigid thing. It's an ebb and flow. We ended up having a lot of our departments, including LAPD when I joined them, was too militaristic. Now the cops were super trained, but in a sense like army trained, you know. And we don't want that, you know, in our cities. We want safety, certainly. We want people that can respond to emergencies, certainly. We want people who are armed, because the bad guys are armed. But we don't want the community member to be a part of that. And instead, we started to enforce the law by having sort of the more and more powerful militaristic police department. And that became uncomfortable to everybody, frankly. Everybody resented the cops. And I'm thinking now of, say, the 50s and 60s. And we had a lot of rioting. We had police riots. We had riots where the police were the instigators, and there were protests of all different kinds going on, including for civil rights, and including for Vietnam, and pro and con Vietnam. But we had them, and a lot of young people suffered greatly in that era. So as they got older, that generation got older, we started to realize that we didn't want cops like that anymore. And slowly, the job of the cop, and it took, in my case, my awareness of it, took to the mid-90s maybe, before we really kind of started to turn the corner. And we're talking about, you know, they always talk about, you know, if you want to turn the Titanic, you got to do it like miles ahead of where you intend to turn, right?
Right. Right.
That's how a police department is too, because you generationally, you have to wait until the older cops have retired or left and are starting to be replaced by younger, medium age officers. And then eventually the youngest of those officers are in that position. And then finally in the position where they are today, there are no officers left from that era. Obviously it's too long ago. And so the entire department has changed hands over that period of time. Unfortunately, actually the federal government had an awful lot to do with why LAPD is the way it is today, because they took over the department. At one point they were fed up enough to have a consent decree where the federal government actually ran the department, and the LAPD had to come to terms with a whole series of things that they were required to do before they could get out from under the consent decree. The consent decree was to last at least 5 years. It lasted eight because they had to accomplish a 95% score on 138 different things. That's the way it was. And so it was all audited. There was a lot of work done. And the upshot is that now we have a police department that is committed to community policing. We had it in the 90s to some degree, and then a chief came in who was sort of that old school style, kind of a ramrod kind of guy, and he started to dismantle everything we had. Well, that's the case here in Albany, too. They got to be careful that they don't allow the current powers that be to take away whatever strides they've already made. That are towards a philosophy that includes the community all the time. That's basically what community policing is. Inclusion. So it's training the officers to trust the community, but it's also training the community to trust the officers. It's a combined effort, in other words, you know, to pull off an increase in the quality of life and a decrease in crime. We all have to be involved, both sides of that equation, as I always say. And so that's kind of a thumbnail history of, you know, the fact that it ebbs and flows. And there are places who have had community policing for a while and then give it up. And unfortunately, I think, my perspective is, they suffer when they do that. That this is really going way, way back, you know, to the 1800s. This is the way it's always been done, and it's always worked, because we know better, you know, what the community is like and who are the good guys and the bad guys and what's going on and all that, than the cop who might not live in our community, serves our community, but lives somewhere else and comes in, and they're constantly on orange, like you said. We're at least green a little bit of the time, we community members. Green and yellow.
I like it. Okay, thank you. That explains a lot. I appreciate that. This has been very very informational for me. Thank you. Educational. Yes, thank you. I learned lots from
I love talking about this stuff. I'm happy to do it any time. We're running out of time tonight, Joe, but thank God you called in, because I would have had to think of all these things to say by myself, and that doesn't work.
I'm glad I called in, too.
Oh, my goodness, Joe. Thank you so much. And I will remind anybody that's listening now that we do shows 6 nights a week, Joe, and tomorrow night's show is a similar style of show, although – we almost never have a problem with multiple community members on a Monday night. The difference is that the theme is from Monday through Friday, Stop Child Abuse Now, as opposed to tonight's show, which is Community Matters This Week. Community Matters This Week is devoted to public safety. Stop Child Abuse Now, Monday to Friday, is devoted to issues of child abuse and trauma. It's prevention, intervention, and recovery. And the NASCO organization usually has multiple people on a Monday night. Same thing, though. We present a series of articles that can be chosen as topics for the evening. And they are pretty much all current event articles, but they deal with child abuse. So I hope other people will call in tomorrow night and through the week. We have a couple of shows that are run by co-hosts who are what we call hyphenate. They're survivors and professionals in one field or another. And a couple other shows later in the week, Wednesday and Friday, where we have special guests who come on and they tell their story. And they start with the story of what happened to them as a child, and they end up at the end of the 90 minutes having discussed the solution, the things that they do, and what their hopes are for the future. So, Joe Koch, I know you're going to be a host through some of those shows. I'm really delighted to have you tonight. And I want to thank you again for being with me. From Los Angeles, this is Bill Murray signing off, as I always do, by saying, may God bless you and the children of the world, and God bless adult survivors of child abuse.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You are forgotten after all.
Blog Talk Radio.